Welcome to the Rooney Report. We are back here again with Mr. Joseph Schuyler. Joe, thanks so much for being with us again.
Yeah, thank you.
During our last program, we were talking about the lawsuit you were involved with, a National Organization of Women versus Schuyler, and we talked about how, you know, you had lost, and then when it went to the Supreme Court, you won there, but then had to go back two other times. And so for our viewers who didn't see the last program, you know, it was pretty tough for you for a while. You could have lost your house, and you spent 26, 28 years of your life in this case.
Yes, it was a burden in a way, but, you know, having a little PR background and some experience, I used it. Mm-hmm. And would get on a lot of talk shows, you know, the O'Reilly Factor and Hannity and so on, and Donahue. I used it. I thought we'd lose it, ultimately. I knew we'd lose it in the court because...
Even at the Supreme Court, did you think you might lose?
I didn't. Well, when the fact that we had lost, first of all, when we asked if they could even use RICO against the social movement, and they said you could, that we were worried.
Right.
We were very worried about the Supreme Court. And I can't say that I was confident at all the two times we went back. But from the, you know, the court, if you've ever been in the Supreme Court during one of their hearings, the lawyers don't get to say much. The justices jump right in, and they really do know their cases. Mm-hmm. And the fact that at one point, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, well, according to your presentation and all, Martin Luther King would have been a racketeer. Well, that helped us.
I bet. Yes.
And then they were able to catch Faye Clayton in some duplicitous statements she said she hadn't made that she had, and they read from the court record and so on. So I nudged Tom. One of the things I said, we won. And he said, all we need is five. But we
and
won.
And you got eight on the first time.
We got 8-1 on the first one, and then we got unanimous, which was 8 because Senator O'Connor had not been.
Oh, okay. You know. Yeah.
So we did win, and as I say, it took a number of years for them to settle. They fought that. Mm-hmm. But it was. It was trying in a way because you were back and forth to Washington and back and forth to the courthouse, and it was wearisome to Anne and the kids and
so on.
But it was, I think it was necessary. But you know, the fact that the court ruled against us was partly because they had anonymous witnesses that could say anything, and we had no time to check what they said, and many of them were just bold-faced lies.
Right. We've seen that in other abortion-related cases.
And then they would bring in, every day, they would bring in some corporal or general or somebody high up who would attest to the fact that abortion was legal and we had been fighting against the law and were breaking the law. And it was gimmicky, very gimmicky.
But yet when you brought a congressman in, you couldn't introduce Congressman Hyde.
Henry Hyde had to be Mr. Hyde, and everybody knows who Mr. Hyde is. They've read Jekyll and Hyde. And I had some very good witnesses. Jack Wilkie was a witness for me. And we had even Father Ted Hesburgh from Notre Dame was ready to come and testify for me. I had gone to Notre Dame, taught there for a while, and he was an old friend.
Sure.
So he would come in to testify, and many of the people that we brought in, they never used. They would keep asking questions until the time was up, and the person that we'd flown in to testify for us would have to go back home.
Sure. Now, you and I spoke a little bit before this about how the way things were, if you were a juror, you may have voted against, I mean, you would have been in favor of the RICO, or you know what I, but because we know that First Amendment is far more important. But the way it was laid out, it just it seemed like the cards were stacked against you in the lower courts.
Well, they were, definitely. The RICO, of course, is it goes against the racketeer, the guy who makes the money, has the crimes committed by another party, and yet gains financially from the crimes that are committed. And that's why the damages for RICO are tripled. Whatever the decision is on damages is automatically tripled. And we weren't making any money.
Right. It was costing
us to do what we did, but they were able to twist it enough that it looked like we were costing them money. They were losing money because of us, which I hope was true. Mm-hmm. But that's not what RICO is. So they didn't really understand it. And five of the original jury were gone by the time the verdict was read. There was only one of the originals there. They had used the alternates. Mm-hmm. And some of them hadn't paid much attention. You could see them yawning and bored. It was a sort of a boring case, you know.
Important outcome, though. I mean, that was we can be thankful for everybody. I know in your book you talk about PETA was glad you won, you know, the people for the ethical treatment of animals.
Oh, yeah.
Because that could have been used against other
That's
groups.
Right. That's yeah. right. We were a trial case for a number of other social movements. Mm-hmm. And but the fact that we did win in the Supreme Court is a healthy sign, because they put using that.
Yeah, no, that's very good. Now, when you were in, was it Selma, Alabama, with Martin Luther King, I mean, you probably had no idea that you'd be years later, you know, being an activist in a different justice related.
No, I never. I was marching down there. I was teaching at Mundelein College in Chicago, and they needed someone to go along to accompany probably 30 or 40 of the students. And so some of the nuns went, and then they asked me if I would go. And so it was quite an experience to stay there at St. Jude's camp. And actually, I left the camp the next morning when we were going to have our march by myself. Mm-hmm. And I almost got hanged.
Yeah.
I stopped to watch a guy decorating his car with Confederate flags, and suddenly I was surrounded by a number of men who had come out of the bar, and they saw the red mud on my shoes from the march, and they said, "What are you doing down here, Yank?" And I said, "Well, I'm a journalist, and I'm trying to get both sides of the story." So let's talk about it. You know.
Yeah.
But there was a fellow from the north in the group, and he asked the others to go back in the bar, and he'd set them up. And then he told me to go back to the camp because there was going to be trouble.
Right, yeah.
And that night...
He could have saved your life there, really.
He could have, because I was seeing myself out on a pine tree hanging. And one guy had a rock, and he kept throwing the rock up and down. Mm-hmm. So I did go back to the camp, and then marched with Dr. King and a very large group down to the Capitol in Montgomery and heard the talks and so on. Mm-hmm. But it was a scary time because the Southerners, many of them, were very hostile to the people who went on the buses. And so they had all the road signs covered up with paper, and they told us not to stop until we got to Nashville on our way back.
Yeah.
So that was the Selma March. We just got on the end of it, but it was part of that sense of injustice that is hard to tolerate. And there were great injustices in the South.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you talk about the guy who was throwing the rock, threatening you. Years later, somebody throws a rock in your picture window your house, right?
They got our dining room window and our living room window. And the house got very cold, and I thought maybe a shelf had loosened and crashed. And I went down and looked all through the house, and I couldn't see anything. Because we have sort of a blind right behind the window, and the rock came in, but the glass fell outward. But the stones were both in the house, and one of them had a message on it that I'm an abortionist, and you will not take away, it had a name of a flower, which turned out to be abortifacient, meaning you won't take abortion away from us. Huh. So I called the press right away and got some pictures, got a picture in the Chicago Sun-Times. So, you know, being the old journalist, you got to use everything you can. So, you know, it's part of the battle.
Right.
And we knew pretty much who it was, but it wasn't anything. But we did get Gilkey in Cincinnati to give us all new windows all through the house as a result of that.
Huh. So, now, how often have you felt, so at that march, I mean, you were a little concerned about if these guys are going to try and do something to you. In all of your years of pro-life movement, and it's been 45, you're 90 now, and half your life you've been fighting the battle.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
How often have you felt threatened, or you've probably had a lot of threats, but many that you were real concerned about?
I was not concerned myself, even though I would get death threats. It was when they would call home when I wasn't there and talk to the children, and they would say, your dad's going to be shot on Chicago Avenue near Michigan, something like that. And that bothered me.
Yeah, that's...
And then the kids themselves were a little embarrassed at times that their father was this racketeer and was in court and all that. I know my daughter Sarah said one time when they were asking in class, what does your father do? She said, I just wish I could have said he's a dentist. You know? And Eric would say, have you got an hour?
Yeah, there you go.
they were good about it. And even the death threats, they'd take him very lightly.
That's good.
Say, well, he'll be home tonight.
I read in your book, usually I think people would be cordial when you speak, but there was one guy who purposely tried to throw up on you. I mean,
oh yes.
how?
That was at Indiana University, and I was speaking in one of these Greek theaters, and a whole group of them came down, the pro-aborts, where they were screaming, so Heil Hitler. So they did that a lot if I spoke alone. That's why I went into debating more, because then they'd have to kind of be quiet, or our little group would shut their guy up. So this one thing situation, I did have a book there from by Dr. Warren Hearn, an abortionist from Colorado, and that was taken. And then one of the gentlemen there induced vomit and threw up all over the speaker stand. He didn't throw up on me, but he got all my papers and everything. And that was rather sickening.
Yeah, that is.
That was kind of, it was Indiana University. And I said I'd never go back there with a police escort.
You know, I think a lot of times people don't take the time to look at things in perspective. We have people who are, there are really pro-abortion people. They like to promote abortion, and the more abortions, the better. They think we should have fewer people or whatever it may be. They can get really upset and excited that you're peacefully protesting, but yet they don't think about the child who can feel pain, the child who was ripped limb to limb, you know, limb from limb, and then just treated so inhumanely. You know, and this is not the first time in history, but it happens throughout history that, you know, a group of people are dehumanized, so to speak, you know.
Right. A couple of slaves were dehumanized, and a lot of other cults have that, where the servants are nobody, and so on. We even read it in scripture, but with the baby is just as valuable as anybody in the world, and it's there, and it's created by God. I mean, even though the parents provide the body, God infuses the soul, which is immortal, and it's the greatest thing. The value of one human life is greater than the whole universe, and we know that. That's just a fact, because we go on forever in heaven or hell, which a lot of people don't believe in anymore, but they will. And so, you have to dedicate yourself to saving these lives if you can, or at least giving them value. When we're out there trying to talk to the women or talking to the doctors or with our truth tour or at a memorial service, we are giving back the humanity to that child. Mm-hmm. Monica Miller wrote a beautiful book, Abandoned, about the baby, how this child is not loved by anybody, and we all need love. Mm-hmm. We need love, and this child is not even loved by its parents, and the doctor treats it like dirt. And with the David DeLeiden's photograph films that we've mm-hmm. been seeing, you see the absolute contempt. It's not just the belittling or denying the humanity, but it's a contempt for the unborn child. They treat it like garbage. They take
and joke about it.
And
yeah.
joke about it. Make yeah. it make it funny. Laugh about it. There's a perversion there that's just yeah. Yeah. it's scary. Mm-hmm. And I see it so much in society, and I don't mean to be negative, but we have lost something that made this country great.
And yeah, we haven't entirely lost it, because I think a lot of the younger people have seemed to, you know, have a greater respect. The younger generation, they say, has a greater or more pro-life than some of the
well,
older
yes, I
generations.
Think so. Yeah,
so I think that's encouraging.
Oh yeah, the fact that there are fewer abortions and fewer out of wedlock pregnancies, not enormous, but it's mm-hmm. it's showing up that I think I have great hope in
yeah,
the new
I
generation,
do too.
And I have so many nieces and nephews and grandchildren and so mm-hmm. on that are very pro-life, and I haven't given up at all.
No.
It's just that we
You're
are...
You're going to go with your boots on until
I'm,
the end.
I'm going to work, you know, die with my boots on, as they say. I used to wear boots. I remember when I went to Australia, that was the big thing. The American with the yeah, motorcycle yeah. boots. I'd taken them from my son, Joe, who with those boots was taller than me.
Nah.
And I said, none of my kids are going to be taller than me. So I took his boots, and they were great. He does drive a motorcycle.
Ah, there you go.
But it's been a great life. Mm-hmm. I don't regret having spent this time. It's not very lucrative.
Hasn't been easy at times. You could have lost your house.
Yeah, we could have lost our house. We could lose our office now. We're having problems. But we keep going mm-hmm. and hope that we're serving the Lord. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing, to have an absolute trust and faith in Jesus, and not to be afraid to say his name, mm-hmm. because he is our Lord and Savior who came down to save us. He suffered. He suffered, and he said that we'd suffer. Mm-hmm. And they're suffering in fighting this battle
right.
against the culture of death. Mm-hmm.
But it's a calling that you've felt and others have felt that, you know, you're...
I had to do it. I didn't have any choice, really. Mm-hmm. They were killing my brothers and sisters, my children, and somebody had to go out and try to save them. And there are many, many, and many of the young people are coming, and they'll mm-hmm. be piling into Washington for the big march. And they go home and do a lot of really wonderful things. In their classrooms and in bringing other people into the movement. My daughter, for a while, she started Generations for Life for young people. And at one of her talks, it was so good on chastity. On the way home, I said, you know, Annie, I think I know why God didn't let me be a priest. He wanted you. Mm. Well, she cried a little bit.
Oh,
but
that's nice.
I absolutely meant that mm-hmm. she had... And it's the same with Eric running the thing, and all my kids are involved. Peter helped me write my book, mm-hmm. spent a lot of time on that. And they're just wonderful kids, and they're having their effect too on their age group.
Yeah.
And then their children are fabulous. We get sure. together and they are just the best kids. I was talking about the Greek philosophers to my little 10-year-old granddaughter,
yeah,
and the knowledge and information that they're getting yeah. in this homeschooling is fabulous.
Now, we live in a time where there's just so much information that can be easily obtained. And sometimes that's not for good reasons, and it can be for very good reasons. And I think there's a lot of hope also in that with technology on the abortion issue, we're seeing the nascent child really is human. Years ago, they'd say it's a blob of cells. It's just tissue. And most people now who are on the internet they know that that's not the case. Yeah. It's not a blob of tissue. And we know that pain starts, early on.
Very early.
Yeah.
Much
yeah.
earlier than they thought. And there was 20 weeks, but it's long before.
Right, yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And to have such a cavalier attitude toward another human being, it's like the old hang, drawn, and quartering and so on.
Yeah.
It just wants to cause pain, doesn't care, treats a human being like garbage, and that's got to stop.
Right, yeah.
And so we do what we can, and I plan to, like you say, die with my boots on. I'm going to keep going.
So in your 90 years, what are some of the highlights for you? Of course, winning that court case would be up there, I'm guessing.
That was up there. My whole life's been sort of a highlight. I mean, the marriage of my children, my
in regards to the pro-life movement. Yeah,
The movement. Well, the fact that it did take hold and became a movement. We thought that the church would be doing it. Mm-hmm. We thought the bishops would be doing it, but it turned out it's the laity, mostly, that is actually running the pro-life movement and doing the hard work and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there aren't a lot of good clergy involved, but it's a lay movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a successful one in many ways because we've saved hundreds of thousands of children. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
They may have killed 60 million here in this country, and it's bad in other countries too. But we know that we've saved a lot, and a lot of the women that have had the babies instead of the abortion are just so joyful over it,
mm-hmm.
that we were there.
Right.
People will come up to you and just say, you know, you were there one day, you were just standing in front of the abortion clinic, but I knew what you were there for.
Yeah.
And we've had interesting events where almost miraculous things have happened.
Yeah. Share with us, if you don't mind, the story of this woman who, it was her first time counseling, and this woman was coming in to have an abortion, and she said something like, well, you know, if you're going to go ahead with it, just let me give you a hug.
Yeah, sometimes that's what it'll take, and it was that hug that changed her mind for her.
Right, then she was sobbing, I guess,
she was
right?
sobbing, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember one time I asked a young girl, I said, don't go in here now, let's go have a cup of coffee. And she was very indignant, but she did. And we mm-hmm. went and talked, and I told her about the baby and so on. And it was near Christmas time, and she said, my hands aren't shaking anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have a wonderful Christmas.
Yeah.
And
she had peace.
You hope she had peace.
Yeah.
And you see that so often, the mm-hmm. women that are talked out of the abortions are just so grateful.
Yes, yes.
And the women who've had them, some of them have had 10 and 20 abortions, and they are just shot.
Although some of them, to me, I've interviewed women who are now part of Silent No More, mm-hmm. they are some of the most vocal and active people in the pro-life movement, and they can reach people that you and I can't reach because they've been there and they regret having done that, and they don't want other women to go through what they've gone through.
That's right. They're very valuable, and mm-hmm. they do wonderful work. And more power to them, because, and they're forgiven.
Yeah.
You know, God is merciful, and you don't know what hardships and problems
right.
they had.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
so
yeah.
We don't blame them. Everybody says we blame. We don't. We don't blame. We're ready to forgive.
You want to help them.
Yeah. I want to help.
So, Joe, in your book, I noticed that, and maybe it's coincidence or providence, that you were at an airport, and here you end up meeting and riding with in a taxi or whatever it was with George Tiller, one of the most infamous abortionists.
Right, from Wichita, yeah. George had, we'd both gotten in very late at the airport. I had had a pro-life rally in Chicago, and I don't know what he had been doing, but we got there together. And he said, would you mind sharing a cab? You're going into New Orleans? I said, sure. So we got a cab together. And he said, what are you here for? And I said, I'm going to the National Abortion Federation Convention. He said, oh, so am I. I'm George Tiller. I said, oh, nice to meet you. And so I just let him think I was going to the convention as an abortionist. And he started talking about using real-time ultrasound to do the abortions. And we had quite a conversation because at that time, the airport was way out of New Orleans. Mm. It was a long ride.
Yeah, quite a ride with
it. And then he stayed in a cheaper hotel, and I was staying in the hotel where the conference was, intending only to picket. I had large group together in New Orleans to picket the convention, but I went downstairs and saw Andy Schulberg, and he had a badge on. Uh-huh. So I said, oh, you're going to the convention? He said, yeah, you just go over there. They've got some kids don't know anything about anybody. So I just went to the hotel, and I ran into Andy Schulberg, and he had the badge for the convention. And I said, you're going to go to the convention? I thought we were just going to pick it. And he said, no, you can just go over there. The person they have there doesn't know anything. So I went over and registered as Joe Scheidler, Action League, left off the pro-life, and got all the little colored things for the banquets and the cocktail parties. And we went to all the meetings. And once they accepted, they knew we were pro-life. Mm-hmm. They tried to get rid of us, but we hadn't done anything.
Right.
So they call in the security, and what do they do? Well, nothing, we just don't want them here. Well, they've got badges. So we went to all the talks.
Wow. Yeah.
And got to hear, but once they accepted that you were there, they just went ahead with their meeting.
Sure, yeah.
And it was amazing, but Tiller at the end was going to show the use of real-time ultrasound in doing an abortion. And he wouldn't show it if I was
there. Because he knew you were there.
He knew I was there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, well, you know, we'll get it somehow from somewhere. And so I left.
Yeah. And then you did get it, right? Yeah.
We did. We got the pictures of the baby being aborted. Mm-hmm. And it's just an awful thing to see. But he was showing us that this is a good thing to do. Mm. Then I would see Tiller, you know, afterwards on the sidewalk and so on. And he was not happy with us being there.
Well, Joe, unfortunately we're out of time, but your book is very good. A lot of interesting, informative information in there. And I wish you another 45 years.
Oh, gee. Good Lord. Right.
Thanks again. We'll be back with the Rooney Report.
We provide the legal defense to the people who really are the last line of defense to these women and these babies. That's why Life Legal does what they do, because someone like Father James Linton isn't going to be able to hire a huge firm and pay thousands of dollars to litigate a criminal case, but Life Legal is able to do that because of the support of our donors and that people find what we do to be important.